Okay, Professor Norman Cornett is a specialist in theology and culture, particularly theology and the arts. He's published numerous Canadian and American magazine articles, as well as being guest professor in many North American and Europe universities. And we talk to him as often as we can. Norman, how are you this morning? Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, Zelda. In fact, I just launched a new book, 158 Fragments of a Francis Bacon Exploded. It's about the British painter Francis Bacon, and who's the subject of a major exhibition right now in Paris.
Oh,
and we had quite a reception at the book launch, and hopefully we'll do a book launch in the coming months in Toronto.
Why did you choose him as your subject for the book?
Well, because Francis Bacon essentially reconfigures the human condition through his visual art. It's quite arresting. He's considered one of the foremost visual artist of the 20th century. We talk about the soundscape. Well, he literally changed the visual artscape through his painting, and his critique of the human body, the human condition, and some of the major figures in Western civilization and culture, not least the Pope. And I'm a religious studies scholar, so that was a draw.
All right. So when will this book be available for listeners to pick up a copy?
Well, it is available now. We just launched it. It's with Ecstasis Editions, which is located in Victoria, British Columbia, and Larry Tremblay, who's one of the foremost Francophone writers on the international literary scene, and I'm not exaggerating. He wrote originally 158 poems on the paintings of Francis Bacon. In my research, I realized that even though he is translated in many languages, his plays, his novels, and the rest, no one had ever translated a single word of his poetry, even though he's been publishing it since 1989. So this is a first. It's the first time ever that this major Francophone writer, his poetry, is now in English through my translation, 158 Fragments of a Francis Bacon Exploded, published by Ecstasis Editions in Victoria, B.C.
Okay, so I hope that people will pick up a copy and read it through and see how they feel about it. All right, so you have always been involved in campus, things that were going on in campus, not always been treated favorably for some of your ideology, which really isn't that different than anyone else. But, you know, that's what they do. They choose one person, and that's the person who I think, you know, gets into the most problems. And that's something that, Norman, you have done quite wonderfully.
it reminds me
of me, but to a much smaller scale in your part. Right.
Well, I don't know that it's smaller, Zelda. You have tremendous impact through your program on Chin Radio, and you're right to point out my engagement in the campus. I am an American, and I was, we're going way back. I was born in 1950, but I was a student body president of my high school, and back in the 60s, that was a big deal. And then I went to the University of California, Berkeley. And, of course, Berkeley, at this time, it's incredible what's happening. So the idea of engaging through creative thinking and creative thought, that's the warp and woof of my life as a student and as a professor.
Do you think that, you know, what you were accused of or charged with or talked about, whatever, and then you were no longer teaching there, is something that wouldn't happen today on campus?
Well, the first thing I'd like to mention, Zelda, is I've never been accused and I've never been charged. In fact, if your listeners see Alanis Obomsawin's film, Professor Norman Cornett, Since When Do We Divorce the Right Answer from an Honest Answer, she is without doubt Canada's foremost native filmmaker. This is the only film, and she's done, she's now part of the history of Canadian film and cinema. This is the only film that she's ever done on a living non-native individual. And in that film, you'll see that I'm trying to find out why this happened. And I'm never told. And to this day, and this all happened in 2007. And here we are, 2020, 13 years later, never told. And
how can you be accused of something if there isn't, a case or something that you can point to and say, no, I didn't do that?
Well, they never see. There are no accusations. There
they
are
just
no
fired
charges.
You. They
a
just
summary
fired.
Dismissal, no. And asked me if I would accept quite a bit of money in exchange for signing a confidentiality agreement to never again speak about my dialogic approach to education. But of course, I'm about dialogue, so I cannot sign an agreement that is essentially a conspiracy of silence, even for a lot of money.
Well, I'm sorry about what you had to go through, but it seems to me that you've come up very, very strong and doing what needs to be done. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about it. I would love to talk about culture. I would love to talk about anything that wasn't political, but that's evading what's happening. And because you're an expert on campus, did you see or find, anti-Semitism growing over the years in the universities that you taught at?
Well, and I continue to go to universities throughout Canada, the United States of America, as well as in Europe. In fact, I was in France in May, and again in France in June, and again in France in September, and I'm supposed to return there. I'd have to say, I'm shocked. There's no other words for it. The recent violent attacks of anti-Semitism. What does strike me, Zelda, is the endeavor to politicize knowledge, to weaponize education. This, Zelda, is a clear and present danger.
Well, freedom of speech. You know, we may not agree with other people's opinions, but we do have a right to hear them as long as they're not, violent or they're not physical. But what we're seeing now is a physical attack. There's this poor rabbi, among many others, who is in the hospital. I'm sure will never regain, his thoughts, his memory, because of hate. I can't even imagine it, Norman. I can't imagine how anyone could hate another human being enough to want to cause them harm.
Well, you brought up another point, and it relates to your Tribune that you enjoyed there with your radio program. What I did see as the change, Zelda, over the years, and continue to see more and more, is as we have so much social media, as there is more and more fake news, alternative facts, and then the deep internet, and where you can have entire enclaves of hate, of white nationalism, and I hasten to point out Christian nationalism. This is a game changer, Zelda. With that kind of information flood, so that you can't see the forest for the trees. So our job one for us engaged in university education, in higher education, is critical thinking. It's analysis. It's learning to separate the wheat from the chaff. And that is even more the case now with this inundation. So the camouflage of what's called cognitive acquisition. The technical term for learning is cognitive acquisition. Well, knowledge, truth, morality, ethics, they are now camouflaged so that you can't see the forest for the trees. And we have to enable them. Essentially, we have the responsibility to become mentors, to become guides through this flooded field of fake news and alternative facts.
Well, and I said, if you really spoke to many, many people, you would find they don't feel that kind of hate. They probably don't think about it. They have lives to live. They have jobs to go to, families to take care of. But those that may have very little in their lives spend them fruitlessly doing and hating other people who do well. Columbia University's anti-Israel bias, 1,879 anti-Semitic acts and anti-Israel in 2018. I don't know whether it's good or bad that at least we can see it for what it is, that we have an idea of where it's coming from. But how do we stop it? And how do we get along no matter what, you know, our religions are or what have you?
Well, the first thing is to humanize, to personalize, to individuate other faiths, other cultures, other ethnicities. And, you know, I'm trained in history, albeit the history of religions. And what struck me, and we call this in academic circles and scholarly milieu, alterity, the otherness. And I came to the conclusion the first way to nip hate, to nip stereotypes, to nip caricatures, to nip these sound bites and where you make a judgment in a nanosecond is to meet them in the flesh, to meet them in person. And so I made it my responsibility to invite rabbis, and I'm not Jewish, but I am a religious studies scholar. And so I invited rabbis into my classroom. I continue to collaborate with many people in the Jewish community. In fact, I spent New Year's Eve at the filmmaker Joyce Borenstein, the wonderful filmmaker who she and I have collaborated for over 20 years together. And so when we meet, and this struck me, you know, because I was born in Texas in 1950, segregation was my reality as a infant, as a child, as an adolescent, as a teenager, as a young adult. And even though the word apartheid was never used, Zelda, the reality on the ground was this. There were no blacks in my elementary school. There were no blacks in my junior high. There were no blacks in the high school. There were no blacks in the neighborhood. And yet they numbered and continue in the many millions. How could this be? Why did we need to keep them at arm's length? So I'll never forget a high school project that I did. I went to a very, very good high school. It was one of the top in the United States, Beaverton High School, a suburb of Portland, Oregon, due to my dad's work. And this is all happening during the beginning of the civil rights movement, Zelda. And I said, you know what? I was in a very exclusive high school, only whites, no other ethnicity or and the like. And so we were given a project to write an essay. And I'm very uncomfortable, Zelda, when we deal with abstracts, when we like the abstract Aboriginal. So I decided to invite Native peoples into my classes. When we theorize the black condition, or when we have hypotheses on the condition of women. So here, this began when I was very young. I was a freshman in high school, and the civil rights movement is going. And, of course, there's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself, like me, studying theology, religious studies, and how that leads into social action for the betterment of society. And I proposed in my high school, well, you know what, just on the other side in that neighborhood of Portland, Oregon, because we lived in a very well-to-do suburb called Beaverton, why don't we go meet them and talk to them what it's like to be black in America? And so I proposed this. We were a committee of high school students. Do you know, Zelda, not a single a student was willing to go with me to the black neighborhood. And here we are in 1964. Not a single, because I was told that it's dangerous in that neighborhood. There are sickness and hygiene issues. You couldn't go into their homes. You certainly could never use their bathrooms.
That this is thoroughly and utterly disgusting.
I
can't believe that we live in this world that is so small-minded and in many cases bigoted. I mean, we've been talking about anti-Semitism, but you're now talking about anti-black at that point as well. So
the phenomena of hate or racism or stereotypes or characters, and get a load of this. What I did is I went all by myself and I went through the yellow pages and I said, who is the local black Baptist pastor? Because I knew that if I wanted to understand the black community, I had to go to the black leadership. And these people, Zelda, they didn't know me from Adam. Here I'm coming from this bourgeois suburb, and I call them and I said, would you receive me and I will bring a tape recorder? It was a life changing experience, Zelda, because I knew from that moment on, I'm not going to believe what people say about Jews or what people say about blacks or what people say about Muslims. I'm going to go right to the horse's mouth and meet them in person.
Well, that was, you know, I don't know if it was courageous, but at that time, maybe some people would have thought so. I would have thought it was normal to want to encourage people to live together, to work together, to be friendly together. But it seems that even though many of things have changed for the better, they haven't really. We haven't really seen a major change of hate. Why? Did anybody ever do a study on why people hate? Is it something different in their brains that others don't have? Or is it just the way they live and the situation that they're in? Have you ever psychologically figured it out?
Well, I actually have worked now for 33 years, Zelda, with well-known psychiatrists, well-known psychologists, dealing with certain phenomena. As I've mentioned in previous interviews with you, Zelda, I've had the privilege of collaborating with Dr. Ivar Mendez, who's at the University of Saskatchewan. He's a international leading neuroscientist, because I too want to get to the bottom of this. How is it that either neurologically or psychiatrically or psychologically, it's called the affective dimension, why do we have these kind of associations? And you mentioned at the outset of this interview the rising incidence of anti-Semitism. No one can deny it. I mean, this is happening.
This has been going on since the beginning of time. There has not been a change. I mean, after the Holocaust, seemingly for a short period of time, there was empathy, sympathy, but not really. And to most people that are not, I don't know if you have to be worldly, you just have to be caring. And you know, that being Jewish was so, I've never met a Jew before. I mean, you know, that's so, to me, so small-minded and so utterly ridiculous.
Well, it's interesting you mention this, Zelda, because, in fact, I've received a mandate to organize a conference on Law 21 here in Quebec. And as you know, Law 21 forbids that people wear any kind of religious symbols when they occupy a public position of authority.
But how can you say that? How can they order anyone not to be proud of me wearing a Jewish star or a cross or whatever the Muslim symbol is?
Sikh turban,
right.
or a Muslim hijab. And in fact, that's why I received the mandate to do it. And it will take place on the 26th of February in Ville Saint-Laurent, which is one of the most multicultural neighborhoods in all of Canada. And I have invited a panoply of scholars from different disciplines so that we can have a public debate on this, Zelda. Why is this coming down? Why is there such a reaction to any kind of religious symbol in the public space? And one of the people I've invited is an internationally known psychiatrist. So these are the kind. There are many dynamics. As far as having a sentence answer to your question, Zelda, it is such a multi-layered issue, but it behooves us to address it from all different avenues and approaches possible. So I have gathered the best available experts in their fields, including an internationally renowned anthropologist and a professor of law and a woman leader, Dr. Samira Laouni, who's a well-known leader of the women's Muslim community in Quebec. And so across the board. But what I want to make clear, too, and you mentioned this at the beginning, Zelda, I created the dialogic approach to education. But dialogue does not mean that we agree necessarily. But what it does mean, Zelda, is the respect of the other, the respect to listen them. We may not go out of that public forum on the 26th of February agreeing with one another, but job one is to create a space of dialogue, and that means respect, respecting the other. And that, without that, we have begun the journey towards hate, towards racism, towards discrimination, and that is what I want to create, a non-threatening environment where we can talk turkey and stop beating around the bush and get down to brass tacks.
But Norman, I don't know if it's anything that you can truly deal with, because when people hate, it overrides anything else that's intelligent in that person. And some people just follow other people's lead. They may not know that they hate. They may not know why they hate. But if someone else creates a fire, instead of putting it out, many people will try to make it bigger. So you can get people together from all walks of life forever, and you may change many of them. But on campus, to see this rise of anti-Semitism, time and time again, because the State of Israel was created in peace, it does more for the rest of the world than anyone else. I don't know if it's possible to stop it. It's just possible for better people to really understand how to fight it.
Well, there's a few things I'd like to say. First of all, yesterday, in reference to the attack that took place in the suburb of New York, there were a number of interviews, and one of the member of the Jewish community said, "It's part of life." I found that shocking. I found that shocking.
It is.
That is part. We have to accept this. We have to consider this the norm. We have to live with this. No, we have a responsibility to do something about it in the body politic. By the same token, Zelda, I cannot change the world. And, you know, I taught it 15 years for the same institution, and I came to the conclusion, I cannot change the institution, but I have a moral and ethical responsibility to that individual in front of me, better known as a student. In the vein of Martin Buber, I and thou. That's the beginning of solving the problem. One on one, I and thou. And the ripple effect. I had the, incredibly, Zelda, 2 weeks ago, I was on the subway here in Montreal, and I was reading the newspaper. And a man gets on, and it was minus 27, so everybody is wrapped up, and you can't really identify people very well because they're covered to the hilt. And a man comes up to me, and he says, "Are you Professor Norman Cornett?" I said, "Yes." He says, "I was your student 15 years ago. I've just returned from China where I built a company, and I want you to know it was a life-changing experience."
Wow, what a compliment to your teaching.
What more can I ask for,
you
Zelda?
You can't. Yeah, that is incredible.
I call that, Zelda, the power of one. That's my priority.
Well, listen, you know,
as an educator.
I always wonder why I'm doing what I'm doing, okay? I always wonder if I have any impact at all, because here I am at this beautiful multicultural radio station that embraces all religions and people of all faiths. And here I am sitting in a small studio wondering if people really get it, if they really understand. And I think, well, why am I not five times larger? You know, like, why am I not? And yet when I can talk to you and have this kind of conversation, it really makes me realize why the power of one is so important.
Indeed. And what does the book of Zechariah in the Hebrew scriptures, doesn't it say, never despise small beginnings? That's how I think.
Well, you've been through quite a bit, and you've come out at the top smelling like a rose. What do you think is what have you learned more than anything else in your educational travels?
The traveling is the best education, and I tell all my students and those with whom I collaborate, because it impels us, Zelda, to see the world through different eyes, to experience through another prism. And so the more that the educator, that the pedagogue can sort of destabilize us and make us think on our feet and make us think new thoughts. Isn't that what it's promised in the Hebrew scriptures? And your children will dream new dreams. That is the beautiful, you know, the movie, A Field of Dreams.
I remember that. Sure.
If you build it,
they will come. Right.
So that's what I seek to do as an educator, and that's what you do there with your program at Chin Radio.
Well,
you're building it.
Well, you know, we've been on the air a long time, and we're now heard in Ottawa. We're now heard across the country. And I think I get my most response and respect from people like yourself, from people who understand the importance of spreading a good word. And you continue to do that, and I will continue to do that as long as God lets me.
That's more and more. I'm now 69, Zelda. I more and more see life as planting a seed that others will harvest.
Well, I think that if people would really understand how important one person is to another and to more than one, it might change the way they think. But people are angry. They wake up angry. They go to bed angry instead of encompassing the good that they can find on a daily basis.
And unfortunately, I mentioned at the outset about fake news, alternative facts, the deep internet. everybody is saying how bad the world is and all the problems we've got. And then, of course, when you build up that kind of, you know, everything's going to H-E-L-L in a handbasket, then they start looking for a scapegoat. So what we need to be doing in the media is bringing solutions rather than saying how bad it all is.
Norman, it's always a pleasure to have you on air. You always bring a breath of fresh air to our broadcasts. And today being January the 2nd, we'll talk again in a few months and see if how things have changed, hopefully for the better. So happy New Year to you, and thank you so much for being a part of our programming.
Thank you, Zelda, and a happy New Year to you as well.
Take care.
Bye-bye.